encouragement to spiritual growth in our congregations, what does it mean? Does it apply only to individuals or to the entire congregation? If Unitarian Universalism is to remain relevant, perhaps it's time for us to move from a spirituality of me to one of we.
Good morning, everyone.
Morning.
I seem to recall that I was going to come visit a while back, and there was a blizzard. Anybody remember that? Yeah. So this is the first time I've actually visited here. And I've been here for like 21 years, so I'm sorry it's taken so long. But it's great to be here, and we'll see what happens snow-wise later today. So, yes, we're going to be talking about the third principle. Apparently you've already been talking about it for a while, so what remains to be said? I'm not sure. How many people know how many times the word spirit or spiritual is mentioned in the principles? How many people know where they would look if they wanted to find out? In your hymnal. Yeah, right. And I already know the answer. Never ask a question that you don't know the answer to. If you're a lawyer, I suppose if you're a minister too, that might be a good idea. It's mentioned once in the seven principles. It's only mentioned once, and it's in the third principle, indeed. It's mentioned actually four times in the sources of our living tradition, but in the principles themselves, it's mentioned only one time. And as we know, if you've been studying it, it's acceptance of one another and encouragement to spiritual growth in our congregations. I think it's interesting that it's only mentioned once. Interesting, but not surprising. When I first became acquainted with Unitarian Universalism in the mid-90s, spirituality was a bit of a controversial subject. For many UUs, the dominant theological perspective was humanist in nature, and agnostics, atheists, religious humanists made up a majority of UUs at the time. So, for example, in 1997, there was a Unitarian Universalism Needs and Aspirations survey that was distributed in an issue of the UU World. And respondents were asked to please check one of the following, which best describes your theological perspective. And there were 10 choices. And humanism was the winner. 46.1%, yeah, of people identified as humanist. And if you want to know the rest of them, earth-nature-centered was 19%, theist was 13%, Christian was 9.5%, mystic was 6.2%, Buddhist was 3.6%, Jewish was 1.3%, Hindu was 0.4%, Muslim was 0.1%, and other was 13.3%. So now you know. So, in that year, in 1997, I was the director of religious education at the UU Church of Bloomington, Indiana. And I remember hearing a story about a longtime UU wondering, what's all this spirituality stuff I hear people talking about? And there were several UUs I knew at that congregation. When they wanted to find a way to deepen their spirituality, they had to co-affiliate with another religious tradition. One would go to a Roman Catholic church, and one would go to the Unity Church, in addition to going to the UU Church. So even though spirituality was and is part of our principles and purposes, it has not always been recognized, at least I think so. It was overshadowed, perhaps, by the principles that could be interpreted in a more humanist sort of way, like the inherent worth and dignity of every person, or the interdependent web of all existence. But at the same time, interest in spirituality was growing in the late 90s. In that same survey, respondents were asked, have you ever considered leaving UUism? If so, why? And 40% 40.6 said no, they'd never considered leaving it, which means 59.4% yes, said yes. And the reason, the number one reason people were considering leaving was lack of spirituality or warmth and joy. That was 29.2% would consider leaving. And if you want to know the rest, congregational conflict was 24.3, too arrogant and cerebral was 19.2, too much political correctness was 19, lack of commitment to fight oppression, lack of diversity was 11.6, and too much spirituality was only 8.6%. So, it's kind of interesting. So that was, what, 25 years ago. I haven't seen another survey since then, so it'd be really interesting to see what people identify as. It might be interesting, you know, I'm not going to ask you now, but maybe sometime if you could do your own survey and see how people identify. So I could see that there was a growing interest in spirituality when I, as I was the director of religious education in the Bloomington congregation, and I remember there was an item in one of the REACH packets that DREs used to receive from the UUA's RE department. REACH, by the way, stood for Religious Education Action Clearinghouse. And it was kind of a thing we did before the web where they would actually send you a whole packet of things to keep you, you know, current with what's going on. Anyway, there was an item from Judith Frediani, who was at that time part of the RE department of the UUA. She actually became the head of it at one time. And it outlined an adult religious education experience based on an article by Barry Andrews, who was a minister of religious education in New York. It was an article called The Roots of Unitarian Universalist Spirituality in New England Transcendentalism. And I remember being so intrigued by that article and the thought that there was such a thing as Unitarian Universalist spirituality. And I was, you know, sort of new to it, but so I'd never heard of that kind of concept before. You know, so that's 1997. But by the end of the decade, just a few years later, you know, it was the end of the century too, and the end of the millennium, the subject of spirituality was being addressed more and more in UU congregations. This book, Everyday Spiritual Practice, was published in 1999. And it was really like one of the first books, first UU books. It was published by Skinner House Books, which is the UUA publishing arm for books that deal with Unitarian Universalism. It was one of the first ones to directly address spirituality. And there were four essays in here that really influenced them. I'll just tell you who wrote them and their names. Arvid Straube has an article called Spiritual Maintenance Schedule. I guess I'll say a little bit more about that. He's saying, you know, we have a maintenance schedule for our cars, maybe we should have a maintenance schedule for our spiritual lives. So it's kind of interesting. Edwin C. Lynn had something called Sacred Moment, which was a wonderful little essay about how to go out and be in nature in like in 5 minutes to be able to just start to be, you know, really communing with nature and absorbing all sorts of stuff. Laurel Holman, who actually was a minister at one time in Bloomington, Indiana, had a wonderful article called Living by Heart. And that was kind of about memorizing poetry, so when you greet the day, you just like kind of let words well up to, you know, help you, you know, greet the day, be present. And Eric Walker Wickstrom also had one in here about prayer, and he actually described using UU prayer beads, which I thought was really interesting. So I'd like to note that three of those authors are what I would call the OG UU spiritual directors. There were only, really, at that time, a handful of people who were Unitarian Universalists who were trained as spiritual directors. That would be Arvid Straube, Laurel Holman, and Eric Walker Wickstrom. So, not long after I was in Bloomington, I started going to theological school in Chicago. So this book came out in the first year, my first year at seminary at Meadville Lombard Theological School. And, you know, it's not surprising, this was a new book, but it had no influence at all of what we were taught there. And I would say my seminary education really was lacking in, you know, deeper understanding of what spirituality is and how it can influence your lives. As a matter of fact, my fellow students and I had to advocate for more opportunities to learn about spiritual practices while we were there. And in order to do that, the administration had to bring in some spiritual directors from the Calvert House in Hyde Park, which was a Roman Catholic mission for students, faculty, and staff of the University of Chicago. So there was nobody on the faculty at the seminary to actually help us with spirituality, except for one person, the librarian, who was one of those people who went to a Roman Catholic church in addition to the UU church. So you get what I'm saying about that? You know, kind of left to our own devices in the 90s. It was, man, what's this spirituality stuff, right? So, but by the middle of the first decade of this century, the importance of attending to the spiritual lives of Unitarian Universalists was becoming more prominent. So in 2006, the UUA's Commission on Appraisal issued a report entitled Engaging Our Theological Diversity. Remember all those questions about, you know, what's your theological perspective? We have a lot of diversity there. But this is what they said in one part of that report. The generations coming to maturity today and in the next decades are showing a renewed interest in spirituality, and if we catch their attention, we can become again a prominent and influential religious movement. It is about catching the wave of people hungry for a sense of belonging and meaning, people who want to place a place where they can safely pursue a spiritual path in the company of people who will support and challenge them, a place that embraces reason yet transcends the rational and touches the soul. And that's a nice quote, and I think it goes a lot farther than the third principle, which is very short, of course, but kind of explaining what encouragement to spiritual growth might look like in a congregation. Roughly 10 years later, too, the UUA bookstore's rather predictable and pedestrian name, UUA Bookstore, was officially changed to In Spirit. Did you know that it's called In Spirit now? Yeah. Right. So we're now at a point where interest in spirituality is a given in many UU circles and congregations. Many of my colleagues, lay and ordained, like me, been trained as spiritual directors, and the UU Spiritual Director Direction Network lists dozens of UUs who offer spiritual direction, rather than just a handful. And for the last 10 years or so, my colleague, Reverend Sue Cinnamon, and I have trained over 100 ministers, religious educators, lay leaders, and youth workers in something we call congregation-based spiritual direction. And in 1998, a follow-up to the 1999 Everyday Spiritual Practice was published by Skinner House Books called Faithful Practices. And this one's actually edited by Eric Walker Wickstrom, who had an article in that first book. So this is all good news as far as I'm concerned. Pretty impressive, actually, given that spirituality is only mentioned once in our principles and purposes. Now, as you may have heard, and actually I want to see hands on this, as you may have heard, the UUA is currently in the process of revising the section of its bylaws that contains the principles and purposes. How many people have heard that? Good. All right. That's good to hear. And it's no surprise to me that given the association's increased, well, not just the associations, but, you know, the general cultures and increased emphasis on spirituality, the proposed revisions mention spirituality more than once. Okay, the words spirit, spiritual, and spiritually are mentioned in the values and covenants section of the proposed changes. Here's the exact wording. We are accountable to one another for doing the work of living our shared values through the spiritual discipline of love. Also, we covenant to collectively transform and grow spiritually and ethically. And finally, we cultivate a spirit of gratitude and hope. Now, I love the idea of cultivating a spirit of gratitude and hope, but for the purposes of this little talk, I'd like to focus on the first two uses of spiritual and spiritually because I think they contain something that our current third principle is missing, or at least doesn't emphasize enough, namely that spiritual growth is a collective experience. I don't know about you, but for the longest time, when I thought about spiritual growth, my mind would go to images of monks and nuns and saints fervently praying. I was just talking to my wife about that. I always thought it was fervently, like reverently, and it's fervently. So, and I just said fervently in front of her, and she was going to say something. Fervently. I said I was going to write it out so I could pronounce it correctly. That's right. Fervently praying. These are the monks and the nuns. They're fervently praying in their chambers. But I think that was influenced by the Bible verse where Jesus says, "When you pray, do not be like the hypocrites, for they love to pray standing in the synagogues and on the street corners to be seen by men. But when you pray, go into your room, close the door, and pray to your Father who is unseen." So I always remember that thing. You know, if you're going to be spiritual, you go and do it somewhere alone. So, to be honest, this take on spirituality, this doing it on your own, perfectly fits with the kind of individualism that our faith, and indeed most forms of Protestantism, promotes. I've heard it referred to as pathological individualism, and it applies not only to religion in America, but to much of our culture as well. So while the third principle affirms and promotes spiritual growth, the word encouragement almost makes it sound like a suggestion, as in, hey, if you're interested in spirituality, go ahead and knock yourself out. Or, in the words of a popular phrase from the previous decade, you do you. But let's take a closer look at these proposed revisions in the UUA's bylaws. We are accountable to one another for doing the work of living our shared values through the spiritual discipline of love. So, when we're doing the spiritual discipline, we're accountable to others. And we can't be accountable to others if we're hiding in our room doing our spiritual thing. Also, we covenant to collectively transform and grow spiritually and ethically. It's something we're going to do together. We are accountable to one another, and we're here to collectively transform and grow spiritually. What this new language advocates is not just an individual spirituality, but something else, a communal spirituality. I first ran across the word, or the concept of communal spirituality, in a book called Embodied Spirits, Stories of Spiritual Directors of Color. It was in a chapter of that book by Sherry Bryant Johnson called Living My Legacy, which details how her experience of the Black church tradition influenced her work as a spiritual director. In the book, in her article, she quotes theologian Michael Battle, who said, "The nature of the beliefs and practices of the Black church can be summed up in the phrase communal spirituality." Now, I confess I don't have a lot of firsthand experience with Black churches, but from what I do know, worship in a Black church is in many ways the polar opposite of what happens in most UU congregations. Indeed, in most white Protestant congregations. Surely, Bryant Johnson does indeed apply the concept of communal spirituality to worship. She talks about designing a worshipful environment where individuals can at once journey toward intimacy with God while growing toward deepening connection with others. So, I would submit that if worship is at the heart of our religious communities, and Sunday morning is probably still the most important event, most important time for most of our UU congregations, then it is the obvious place for us to practice communal spirituality. There are many things we already do in our worship services that can be transformed into communal spiritual practices. And we already do a lot. to some extent. So I noticed there's meditative music coming up, you know. So we have elements, right? And many congregations do moments of silence, right? We're doing these things. But those moments of silence are usually 1 or 2 or 3 minutes long. And silence as a communal spiritual practice could be much, much longer. So, as in singing could be more meditative too. It's one thing to rise in body and or spirit and sing a hymn together with a clear beginning, middle, and end, but it's another thing to sing a simple melody over and over again without a predetermined stopping place and allow the congregation to kind of collectively agree when to bring it to an end, which is a more meditative way of singing. And readings and meditations can benefit from being heard more than once, as in the practice of Lectio Divina. How many people are acquainted with Lectio Divina? Okay. High five. So what Lectio Divina usually is a reading, a short passage from the Bible. It's a Christian practice from the Bible. Multiple times, and each time you read it, you have a moment of silence, and that moment, like I said, could be longer than 1 or 2 minutes. You read it 3 times, and each time you hear the passage, you're kind of looking at your response to it, and the first time you hear it, you're looking for a word that might have caught your imagination or moved your spirit or your soul. And then the second time through, you're kind of seeing how you feel about it. What's the feeling you have when you hear those words? And then the third time you hear it, you open yourself to an invitation. Is there something inviting you in these words to do something, to change something in your life? It's a spiritual practice that works particularly well with groups. And Unitarian Universalists that I know, we usually use poetry rather than scripture, which is fitting because, well, 2 reasons. We really don't have any single scriptures that we claim for our tradition. And also a psychology professor named Guillaume Thierry explains that poetry appears to be built into us. Every human being is an unconscious poet. So, how late do you go here?
11.
11.
And time for questions.
Oh, okay. All right, we're going to do Lectio Divina, everybody. But we're not going to take, 5 minutes in each thing because we don't have enough time for that. But we're going to give you a taste of it, and then I have a proposal for you. So, we're going to give it a try, okay? Is that all right? You want to give it a try? Okay. I found this poem from a poet named Dorothy Walters. She just died this last February. She's like 93. She was an English professor. I think last I heard she was in Wichita teaching. She practiced Kundalini yoga, and she had one of those awakenings. And it changed her life, and she started writing mystical poetry for like a long time. That was what she kind of dedicated her life to. So I have a poem, I'm going to read it 3 times, and I'm going to look at my watch, I'm going to set my stopwatch, and we're just going to have a few moments of silence, and I'll give you your cue about, what to think about. So the first time you hear it, just listen for a word that kind of moves you. And I give you permission in that silence, if you want to say that word out loud, feel free to. Okay. All right, so this is called Don't Make Lists. Every day, a new flower rises from your body's fresh soil. Don't go looking around for fallen petals in a fairy tale. When you've got the golden plant right here, now, shooting forth in light from your eyes, your awakening crown. Don't make lists or explore ancient accounts. Forget everything you know and open. So I'll read it again. Let me just say fresh soil were the words that kind of jumped out at me that time. So I'll read it again. And just, what are your feelings? What do you feel when you hear the poem? Don't make lists. Every day, a new flower rises from your body's fresh soil. Don't go around looking for fallen petals in a fairy tale when you've got the golden plant right here, now, shooting forth in light from your eyes, your awakening crown. Don't make lists or explore ancient accounts. Forget everything you know and open. So I'm going to read it one more time, and we're looking for an invitation. And I'll just say, too, my feeling that second time I read it was a little frightened. I'm always that way with the idea that spiritual practice might open you up to something that's so much larger than yourself. That's a little frightening prospect. So. But this time through, we're looking for an invitation. Don't make lists. Every day, a new flower rises from your body's fresh soil. Don't go around looking for fallen petals in a fairy tale when you've got the golden plant right here, now, shooting forth in the light from your eyes, your awakening crown. Don't make lists or explore ancient accounts. Forget everything you know and open. I would say the invitation for me was forget everything you know. Wonderful invitation. So if we're going to talk, we can move right into this right now. I'm curious of what people's experience was and just their thoughts on the proposal that my colleague Sue Cinnamon and I have is that we begin to look at our church year and plan on having a certain number of services throughout the year that would be more focused on doing things like this collectively. Doing Lectio Divina, doing something with music that's maybe a little bit more spiritual, using repetition and chant and things like that, and make that part of our flow of how we do our worship on Sunday morning. So thoughts about Lectio Divina, thoughts about maybe bringing more spiritual experiences and practices into worship? Thoughts about other things?
Have you by chance read or heard of Brian McLaren's book, Faith After Doubt?
I may have heard of it.
Okay. Well, I'll summarize it. I want to put a question to you. It deals with stage theory, which people have in different ages and in different forms. And Dick Dahl and some others, and whom I know have also read this book as well, so others can feel free to correct me if I don't summarize it correctly, is that all of us go through our lives a natural progression in terms of faith. My perception, and here comes the question, is that you tend to stall out or get stuck in what Brian McLaren calls stage three, kind of like this intellectual cerebral, you know, atheism or humanism. So here's the question to you. Do you think that UUs are stuck in their heads too much and too resistant to the possibility of spirituality beyond the Sunday school simple stuff that we had shoved down our throats and that a lot of us have since reacted to? Mm-hmm.
As I said, certainly in the 90s when I got, you know, first introduced with working with Unitarian Universalists and being part of a Unitarian Universalist congregation, you know, the idea of learned clergy, that what ministers brought to a congregation was a good sermon that made you think, you know, and not something that, well, good preachers can move your heart and things like that, but not something that stirs your soul necessarily. And again, good preachers can do that, but we were trained really to do the more intellectual sermons. So I think the leadership, you know, certainly from the clergy, was kind of, in many ways, keeping us in our heads. And the groups that formed, you notice that the Earth Center group was the second largest group. Well, the Covenant of UU Pagans has been around for a long time, and that was one of the main groups that brought an awareness of spirituality into our congregations, in that sense, Earth-centered spirituality. So I think we're less stuck in our heads, but I do think we need to be intentional about opening ourselves more up, more to this, like this poem, to be open. And as I said, I think the obvious place to do it is when we're together on Sunday mornings, to at least let people know this is part of our faith tradition. And as I said, you know, it's only mentioned once in the current principles and purposes, but that those revisions kind of are opening it up to something more. So yes, I agree with you, but I think we're on our way somewhere.
There is a kind of singing that I'm not sure if I can remember the kind of the term, but it's either singing in the open tradition or the living tradition. A friend of mine who led a group up in St. Paul, Barbara McAfee, it might be that she could come down and teach us how to do it. We would get everyone in a circle. We would have to rearrange the chairs. She or the leader would teach the parts, you know, it might be something, a simple song where you could learn the parts right there. And then you stand and you practice it until you got your parts. And then you start walking around, passing each other as you do it, walking slowly and doing this singing. It is one of the most powerful things that I have ever experienced. My son died when he was 26, and this is the only time that I have ever actually broken out in sob about it. It was, and so I've wondered how to bring it to down to Winona before. We've talked about it in the Interfaith Council. But I can just imagine us doing this. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, that's a good example.
Hello. Okay. I just want to reflect back my experience with the Lectio Divina thing. And I think I didn't expect it to be as powerful as it was for me, but I think all spiritual practices are a part of my life, so I like individual practice, and I have rarely experienced communal practice, I would say, other than in like meditation retreats and stuff, mm-hmm. Or in theater, really, I think is a communal practice mm-hmm. of spirituality. But I think that for me that it was really interesting because I've heard poetry read many times before. And it's just in the framing of it, of this is like sacred, and this is something that we're going to do together, and this is like, and holding that space of like a moment before we enter into this like kind of journey, and this is how long this journey is going to be, and this is exactly what you can expect. And somehow that like allowed my mind to let go of a cerebral sort of interrogation of what I might be learning, and allowing myself to kind of relax into a space of really experiencing the words and how they fell like water, you know, mm-hmm. boom, boom. And it was like raindrops. Mm-hmm. And so it was like, I didn't really, it was like my mind was really kind of far away from the words, but they were influencing the experience I was having. And then, like, as it continued on, it was interesting during the second part, I forgot that the last part was an invitation, but the second part I felt an invitation from a higher self, a higher thing, and an invitation to join into an experience. And so I thought, wow, that it was so small or so concise, but yeah, the way it was held and stuff, really was fruitful.
Thank you. And you really kind of explained what a good communal spiritual practice does. You need to explain it, you need to set the boundaries so people can open themselves up to it, and you just have to hold the space then. And that's something we can all learn to do and share with each other. And yeah, there's real benefits, I think, that happen. That might be, especially because it's a shared experience, too. I don't know, feel free maybe to chat amongst yourselves afterwards if you did have some you know, invitation or what words stood out for you. But it's something we share now. I agree with you. And let me just say, when my colleague Susan Cinnamon and I imagine doing this, the communal worship spiritual experience would be bounded on each side with opportunities to do small group stuff as well. It would be, you know, let's say we were doing poetry one season. And so we would do some of the poetry individually in small groups. And then on one Sunday, we would do something like Lectio Divina together. And we could be doing the same thing with doing meditative singing, you know, in smaller groups, and then do it together. So I agree with you, yes. This can be done in many places and in many ways in a congregation and a fellowship. So thank you. All right.